There was never any reason to expect that the presidency of Donald Trump would end with appropriate stately decorum, and indeed, it isn't. But as we go to air, ending it surely is. As President Donald Trump labours to push the resolute desk and other furniture up against the doors of the Oval Office, this special live episode will look at what happens next. How will presumptive President-elect Joe Biden handle the challenges of a polarised nation, an untamed pandemic, and a struggling economy? How hard will it be to repair America's image abroad? And will the Republican Party remain the party of Trump or find a way to reinvent itself? This is The Foreign Desk.
The poll worker just came out and announced the polls are open.
Results of the U.S. election between President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden rolled in without a clear winner yet.
We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
We knew because of the unprecedented early vote and the mail-in vote, that it's going to take a while. We're going to have to be patient until the hard work of tallying the votes is finished. And it ain't over till every vote is counted.
Joe Biden is inching closer towards victory in a U.S. presidential election. The Democratic candidate is gaining momentum in the handful of states that will determine the outcome.
So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us.
We don't have a final declaration of victory yet, but the numbers tell us a clear and convincing story. We're going to win this race.
Hello and welcome to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined today for this live episode by Amy Pope and Jeffrey Howard. Jeffrey Howard is Associate Professor of Political Theory at UCL, and Amy Pope worked with Joe Biden when she was Deputy Homeland Security Advisor to President Barack Obama, and she's now Associate Fellow at the US and the Americas Program at Chatham House. Jeffrey, I'll bring you in first. I used the phrase presumptive President-elect Joe Biden in the intro there. I think we need first to insulate ourselves against the possibility of perpetrating Monocle 24's own equivalent of the Chicago Tribune's Dewey defeats Truman headline of 1948. So first of all, Jeffrey, is there at this point any real doubt about this anymore?
The path for the president has narrowed so considerably in recent days that it seems highly, highly unlikely that the president will be reelected. It's just a matter of time, it seems, until it's called. It seems that the decision desks are just being cautious. They don't want to jump the gun. And I think that's really sensible, because if they jumped a gun while recounts are still taking place, while votes are still being counted, it would simply give more ammunition for the president to dish out the kind of disinformation and conspiracy theories we've been hearing so much of in the past few days from him.
Amy, to bring you in, the period immediately after anybody's been elected president must be an extremely strange and disorienting one for them, the more so in circumstances such as these. As I was saying when I introduced you, you used to work with, I think we're calling him presumptive President-elect Joe Biden, quite closely. He is now this close to the job he has wanted his entire adult life. How do you imagine this would be feeling for him right now? Are you able to sort of take a wild guess at what he would be thinking?
I mean, I'm not sure anyone anticipated adversary like Donald Trump on the other side, especially when one's thinking about running for president. So it's hard to put oneself in those shoes. But, you know, he knows Washington incredibly well. He knows how the White House works. He knows how the transition works. He prepared a transition when Donald Trump won. And so, you know, he is business as usual. There's a team that's working very hard to figure out how to implement a President Biden's vision. And while it is very distracting to have all of this going on in the background, I think they're very much focused on just preparing for the future.
We will come to the transition itself shortly, but Amy, I just want to follow that up quickly, because the transition period is a strange quirk of the presidency, that you effectively have someone still in charge after they've been voted out. But this is going to be a very, very strange one because we don't really understand how this works. What's your take on what role Biden should now play? Because on the one hand, he is the presumptive next president, but also until he takes the oath, he has no actual power whatsoever. But because of the peculiar circumstances, is he going to be obliged to try and find a way to assume some sort of leadership role?
Well, in terms of leadership of the American people, he can't do much more than what he's been doing, which is to give sort of regular evidence-based updates, effectively, right? He is going to be very careful about not falling into the trap that Donald Trump has fallen into, which is to stray from the facts, to stray from the vote counts, to suggest a situation that doesn't actually exist. So, again, I think he's going to stay very focused on where are we in this process. It may become necessary at some point to push forward the process through, frankly, litigation if the president refuses or the president's team refuses to allow for transition. But that's still a ways away.
Jeffrey, we have talked a few times over the last 4 years that if we're trying to see an upside to Donald Trump's presidency is that it has provided America's institutions, its checks and balances, with something of a workout, a stress test for the entire system, if you will. And in the last few days, we've seen a few of the lawsuits that Trump's campaign have already attempted to bring get more or less laughed straight back out of the court by the judges they were brought in front of. Is there something, or at least are you able to find something heartening in that, that for all Donald Trump's authoritarian posturings and possible demagogic desires, he is finding this vast American system not really so far willing to go along with it?
Well, like you, Andrew, I'm always looking for silver linings in what are otherwise pretty dark situations. But given that we're not out of the woods yet, I'm not so sure. It seems unbelievable that Donald Trump would do what, curiously, Laura Ingraham on Fox News exhorted him to do last night, which is if it turns out that he is the loser in this election, and it's certainly looking that way, he should bow out gracefully and graciously. He should concede, and by doing so in the kind of dignified way that his predecessors have done, he can command the kind of lofty authority within the Republican Party moving forward that he might otherwise squander if he goes kicking and screaming. But it seems highly unlikely that he won't go kicking and screaming. This is a president, of course, who loves the limelight and who loves to cling to media attention until the last moment. So I think we'll continue to see the lawsuits, we'll continue to see him spewing disinformation about this election. It's true that so far American institutions have held up okay, but sitting U.S. senators from the Republican Party have been mimicking the disinformation that the president has been spewing about this election being stolen. And when we're evaluating the degree to which institutions can hold, I think it's vital to remember that institutions are partly comprised of moral norms that people have to decide to cooperate with. And of course, some people are complying with those norms, but others aren't. And this period between now and January 20th could still be extremely dangerous. So as I say, we're not out of the woods yet.
I mean, Amy, it strikes me that the role Joe Biden finds himself in at this point is rather like that person who walks in between two angry, brawling mobs in a bar with his hands raised in either direction saying, everybody, please calm down. He might have another 10 weeks and change ahead of him before he is sworn in. Do you anticipate that what we're going to see is pretty much what we have seen from him, certainly in the days since the election? Just everybody keep calm, everybody keep focused. Has he understood basically from the moment he won the nomination that his path forward is just to walk in a straight line and try not to get sucked into things?
Yes, and more than that, to show that he is the leader that the country has been looking for. Basically, he's the adult in the room. And despite the antics of Donald Trump and his children and, you know, some of his advisors, that he is going to hew very closely to the Constitution and the rule of law and the norms and kind of hold up the American flag and the democracy and stand behind that. I mean, that really is his best way forward. Playing in the same game that Donald Trump is playing in is just not a winning theory here. And so He wants to demonstrate that he is the person who can come and bring some kind of order back to the country.
And Jeffrey, just finally for this first part of the show, I don't wish to catastrophize untowardly, but if Donald Trump decides that he is going out, possibly literally as well as metaphorically, kicking and screaming, how much damage is he still equipped to do?
I think he's equipped to do an enormous amount of damage in terms of delegitimizing the Biden presidency in the eyes of some 40% of the country, perhaps, or at least 40-some percent of people who voted. And I think that's catastrophic because it gives political incentive for Republicans in the Senate to refuse to cooperate with Joe Biden on all sorts of initiatives, from COVID relief packages to action against climate change. It gives them the political cover and political incentive not to work with this administration. And that would be really, really bad for the country.
Jeffrey Howard and Amy Pope, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you later in the show. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Now, barring something bizarre, even by contemporary standards, Joe Biden is now 74 days from being sworn in as president. Here's his story so far. There really is no accounting for the mood swings of the American electorate in US presidential elections. In the last half century alone, they have lurched from the fretful liberal Jimmy Carter to the optimistic conservative Ronald Reagan, from the somber patrician George Bush to the breezy small-town charmer Bill Clinton, and thence to another George Bush, this one a swaggering Texan good old boy at pains to project a certain suspicion of fancy pants highfalutin book learning, then to Barack Obama, as fancy pants a highfalutin book learning president as had occupied the White House since John Adams, and then to Donald Trump, Obama's polar opposite in absolutely every way imaginable.
Build that wall. 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 Build that wall.
Arguably for the first time, such an abrupt gear change makes obvious sense.
I say that you're a terrible reporter. That's what I say.
After 4 years of President Donald Trump's rage, chaos, division, spite, incompetence, petulance, and stupidity, it's not difficult to perceive the appeal of calm, cheerful, equable, affable, experienced, familiar Joe Biden.
We choose hope over fear.
The United States has chosen to replace a man who knew nothing of politics with a man who has known little else. On January 20th, the ultimate outsider president will be succeeded by the ultimate insider.
You remind me of something my dad said. He said, Joey, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about your place in the community. It's about respect. It's about being able to say to your kid and look him in the eye and say, everything's going to be okay, and mean it. That's what job's about. A decent paying job like the UAW provides.
Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. was born on November 20th, 1942, in Scranton, Pennsylvania. At 78, he will become not only the oldest president ever sworn into their first term, but the oldest person ever to have done the job. Biden's family moved from Pennsylvania to Delaware when he was a child, his father eventually a successful used car salesman. At school and at university, Biden focused on politics and law and was a decent high school and college athlete, playing football for the University of Delaware's unintimidatingly named Fightin' Blue Hens.
The offensive line for Delaware will have...
He eventually earned his law degree from Syracuse University, but was an undistinguished student and then an undistinguished lawyer. He was, nevertheless, a young man in a hurry. He ran for and won a county council seat in Delaware in 1969 and ambitiously and successfully leveraged that position for a crack at the US Senate in 1972. Biden was regarded as a hopeless long shot, but even amid a presidential election which saw Republican incumbent Richard Nixon win 49 states, Biden narrowly wrested a Senate seat for the Democrats. He was not quite 30. That unlikely triumph was swiftly followed by unimaginable tragedy. A few weeks after his election victory, Biden's wife, Nelia, and one-year-old daughter, Naomi, were killed in a traffic accident. His two sons, Beau and Hunter, were badly injured. Biden was sworn in for his first term at Beau's bedside. In order to take care of his surviving children, Biden developed the habit, which he maintained throughout his 36-year stretch in the Senate, of commuting daily by train, 75 minutes each way, between Washington, D.C. and Wilmington. He remarried in 1975 to Jill Tracy Jacobs, a teacher. They had a daughter together. Biden made his first run for the US presidency in 1988. An initially promising campaign unraveled after he was busted lifting speech lines from Neil Kinnock, then leader of the UK's Labour Party.
And I started thinking as I was coming over here, why is it that Joe Biden is the first
Kinnock in a thousand generations to be able to get the university? Why is Gladys the first woman
in her family to ever go to college? No, it's not because they weren't as smart. It's not because they didn't work as hard. It's because
there was no platform upon which they could stand.
He tried again in 2008, but was always going to struggle for attention in a Democratic primary race dominated by the possibility of the United States' first black president or its first female one. It turned out, however, that there was a role for an aging white guy with a reassuringly familiar face. Barack Obama selected Biden as his running mate.
Now, with Joe Biden at my side, I am confident we can take this...
They won, and won again in 2012. Vice President Biden was one of very few occupants of the office who has given any impression of enjoying it. It is traditionally the preserve of thwarted sulkers who plot and scheme against the incumbent, or thuggish consiglieres who wrangle and menace on the president's behalf. Biden played it as a cheerleader for the president and the country and seemed altogether at ease with being caricatured as Barack Obama's daffy uncle.
You know, Barack and I, we've been through a lot together in these 4 years. And we learned about one another, a lot about one another. And one of the things I learned about Barack is the enormity of his heart. And I think he learned about me, the depth of my loyalty to him.
Biden's decision not to seek the presidency in 2016 is a colossal what-if moment. If he'd beaten Hillary Clinton to the nomination, he might well have had a better chance of beating Donald Trump in the election. He would not have been burdened by Clinton's baggage or the different rules of conduct unfairly imposed upon women. It was notable that Biden felt able, during a 2020 presidential debate, to speak for many by calling Trump a clown and telling him to shut up, whereas Clinton did not. But the 2015 death of Biden's son Beau, aged 46, had shattered him, and he didn't perceive sufficient ground to stake between Clinton and the other contender, Senator Bernie Sanders. Biden's 2020 tilt initially felt more like a chaotic quest for redemption than a serious undertaking. Not for the first time, he was underestimated by many observers. Now that he has the job he has wanted his whole life, a Herculean task of stable cleaning, or perhaps, to update the myth, swamp draining, awaits. The next 4 years are a challenge, such is the wreckage he inherits, but also an opportunity. Not for President Joe Biden, the curse of following a tough act. And after the last 4 years, there will be a great many people in the United States and around the world who won't much care what he does, as long as he does it quietly. This is The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Amy Pope and Jeffrey Howard. In this part of the show, I want to try and look ahead to the near future. And Amy, first of all, there is a long established tradition whereby a great deal is hung upon the first 100 days of an incoming administration. Now, for all sorts of reasons requiring no reiteration, Joe Biden faces an unusually intimidating intray. But what do you imagine he will want to do first, or at least soon?
Number one is COVID response. The COVID response of the United States has been, it's hard to find the right word to describe how disorganized, chaotic, contradictory, and confusing it's been. And the role of the federal government can be to lay out a path forward. Now, of course, the states and the counties have to implement a lot of that, but you need the leadership from the top in terms of what are the bright lines, what are we trying to get to, and then providing the resources to help them get there.
Jeffrey, another challenge he is going to face is that this election has demonstrated that Donald Trump not only has still an amount, not just an amount of support in the country, but actually an increasing amount of support in the country. Biden has made all the right reassuring noises about wanting to govern for all Americans, et cetera, et cetera. But what do you do to convert that sentiment into practical politics? How does Joe Biden reach out?
Well, I think it's going to be really difficult, certainly with respect to Republican politicians. If the Republicans indeed hold the Senate, and the composition of the Senate is as yet unclear, thanks to some of these runoff races in Georgia, it's going to be a serious obstacle to Biden getting any legislative initiative past Congress. I think it's highly likely that we'll hear the Republicans, notwithstanding the way they ballooned the deficit by trillions of dollars through the tax cut under the Trump administration, revert to talking about austerity and how all of these Democratic proposals are just too expensive for the country. And so I think it'll be very, very difficult, certainly if Republicans control the Senate, for Biden to get any serious COVID relief package through legislatively. Now, and even if Democrats control the Senate, however, it will still be difficult precisely because of the filibuster. And that's why people are talking about the possibility of some kind of massive movement to change the filibuster, whereby just having 50 votes plus the president of the Senate, who would be Kamala Harris as the vice president, would be the tiebreaker to allow that kind of legislation to go through. So on the political level, I think it's going to be very difficult. Now, in terms of the voters out there in the country, Biden's going to need to do a lot of outreach. He's going to need to try. I don't think it's going to work over Zoom. He's going to have to try to do some socially distanced events where he goes into deep red communities and so picks up the kind of media coverage and is seen as trying to reach out to people. I think he'll make all the right notes in terms of rhetoric, but whether that will make any material difference on the ground in terms of how people perceive him as legitimate or otherwise, well, that remains to be seen.
And Amy, to put you on the spot and answer a 192-year-old question, how does he stop the Democratic Party from fighting amongst itself?
I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, look, we're already hearing reports of members of the House in their meeting sort of pointing fingers at each other. You know, the folks on the AOC on the very left side saying, look, we brought key voters to the table who wouldn't have voted otherwise. And those who are more in the middle saying, look, you cost us votes in places like Florida and Donna Shalala's seat, which we shouldn't have lost because you have, you know, sort of allowed the party to talk about or be labeled as socialists. So, I mean, it's been, you know, I don't think there's a really straightforward way forward at this point. There's going to continue to be infighting, I'm afraid.
And Jeffrey, there's also a Herculean task of rebuilding abroad that presumptive president-elect Biden, it's not growing on me as a phrase, is going to have to do. Donald Trump's presidency, I think it's fair to say, has not been good for America and the world, except for perhaps for his outreach to what we might think of as non-traditional American allies like Russia and North Korea. Where does Joe Biden even start? I mean, presumably he will have a considerable reservoir of relief to draw upon, but what does he prioritize?
Well, certainly with respect to foreign policy, re-entering the Paris Climate Accord will be a high priority for this administration. I also think trying to patch together the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, will be a serious priority for this administration. And just making the right noises in terms of support for NATO, for support like international bodies like the UN that have been so thoroughly abandoned by the current administration will be extremely important. And I don't think we can overestimate the impact of presidential rhetoric, the use of the bully pulpit, not simply to influence people at home domestically, but also to indicate the kinds of commitments abroad that America, since the end of the Second World War, has engaged in to help stabilize the international order and give hope and comfort to the allies of liberal democracy and human rights around the world who haven't gotten that kind of support from America over the past 4 years.
I mean, Amy, is it possible to tell yet which of America's traditionally friendly relationships he is going to regard as most important? I mean, we have seen Fiji already offer him congratulations. I think they are the first government to do that. But enterprising though that is, I think it's probably unlikely that that'll be the first call he makes.
Look, I think, you know, we can probably game this out pretty easily. The European countries are all important allies. We'll see a recommitment to all of the countries here, including and especially the UK. Mexico and Canada, likewise, will be important partners, and I expect early relationship building or repairing there. Likewise, South Korea. I mean, the real interesting thing for me will be what happens in places like the Middle East, where the Donald Trump reset there has left many of them sort of dreading a Biden presidency, and watching how that will play out, and likely watching many of those relationships diminish in importance will be interesting.
Jeffrey, we should also discuss the potential role of the vice president in the immediate, well, in the immediate aftermath, doesn't seem like quite the right word, but the immediate aftermath of the inauguration, because once again, Donald Trump has succeeded in making everything all about him. It has been, I think, less celebrated than it would normally be. What a moment this is, that there will be the United States' first female vice president, its first black vice president. Does she have a more significant role to play than somebody in that position normally would?
I mean, it remains to be seen whether President Biden would treat Vice President Harris as a close advisor, as deeply involved in White House policy discussions, in much the same way that George W. Bush elevated the role of the vice presidency with Vice President Dick Cheney. And indeed, President Obama included Vice President Joe Biden extremely thoroughly in top-level White House deliberations. And this really is about the personal working relationship of Biden and Harris. And I just don't think we know enough yet about that relationship to see what kind of a vice president Kamala Harris will be. One thing that's clear, though, is that her elevation to this office is of monumental symbolic significance for the country. And just thinking about the little black girls across America who will be able to look up and envisage themselves becoming vice president or indeed president one day is just incredible. And let's not forget, of course, that presumptive president-elect Biden is 77 years old. And so it's not clear that he will be even interested in running for a second term, in which case we may well yet be talking about the possibility of a Harris presidency.
And Amy, just finally for this part of the show, and as somebody who has been up close watching Joe Biden make decisions, I would be interested to know your thoughts on one decision he might well find himself having to make, which is what he does about actual Donald Trump. Now, it has been suggested or that there is a comparison here to be made with Gerald Ford succeeding Richard Nixon and deciding to pardon Nixon in advance for any federal crimes he may or may not have committed in order to unify the nation, bind the wound, draw a line, or whichever cliche you're having yourself. Which way is Biden likely to tack on this, do you think? Does he just want to put Donald Trump as far behind the United States as he possibly can? Or will he think that there might be an argument for turning prosecutors and investigators and committees loose to absolutely get to the bottom of everything that might have gone on?
Well, I don't think it'll be either extreme, really. I mean, there are reportedly existing investigations into the president's misconduct on a whole wide range of issues, from campaign finance to tax evasion to the ways he's used his money. So I anticipate that those will continue. I suspect that some of those have been held because the president has been in office, and whether that now clears the way for those investigations to proceed, I think that is a real possibility here. I think the president, President Biden, though, is going to play a much more traditional role. He's going to let the Justice Department do what it does, which is to investigate and prosecute independent of the president of the United States. I mean, it's been very, very unusual to have Donald Trump weigh in on what the FBI should be investigating or what the U.S. attorneys or the attorney general should be prosecuting. I don't think we're going to see a repeat of that. So it will be, again, what is the evidence? What are the facts? And let that play out without political interference.
Amy Pope and Jeffrey Howard, thank you both very much for joining us on the Foreign Desk. Now, the 2020 presidential election may have ended the presidency of Donald Trump, but it was not a repudiation of what he and it stood for. More than 70 million Americans, none of whom can have been under any illusion about what they were voting for, wanted four more years of it. The Republican Party now faces a dilemma of its own. Does it assume that Trumpism is the future, even if Trump isn't, or does it attempt to reinvent itself? Well, earlier I spoke to Nicholas Lemon, New Yorker staff writer. I began by asking if a personality cult can survive without its personality.
I guess we're going to find out soon. The latest rumor here in the U.S. is that if the president ends up leaving office voluntarily or not, he's going to immediately start something called Trump TV. We don't have to live without him for even a minute after he leaves office. There are Trump-like leaders all over the world. So in a sense, there's something about the times we're in that produce authoritarian right-wing leaders who are sort of use populist rhetoric and have big flamboyant style and personality. Having said that, I don't see anybody else in the Republican Party who can step in and be the new Trump, with maybe as a possible exception, there's a television host named Tucker Carlson, who's sometimes mentioned as a potential candidate. He commands a big audience. He's not as outrageous as Trump, but he knows what courts to hit. There's a young senator named Josh Hawley from Missouri who also seems to be sort of moving into the Trump lane. But it's hard to imagine that you'd see somebody with the president's unique personality coming in unless it's Donald Trump Jr.
Let's move on from that happy thought and talk about the three possible futures you've previously delineated for the Republican Party, which will have some sort of future. You separated them into remnant, restoration, and reversal. Can you briefly explain each of those in turn?
Yes, I can. So I want to say as a sort of consumer warning, these are terms I made up. They're not terms that other people are using yet. So remnant would be the idea that the Trump constituency would live on with this very brightly colored rhetoric about a national crisis and occupying a smaller and smaller part of the population. They would sort of cling to power through sheer aggressiveness and exploiting various vulnerabilities in our electoral system. So that's number one. Restoration would be the idea that the Republican Party can kind of go back to normal as the party of business, which it's been for over 100 years, and return to a more sort of Ronald Reagan-like stance of lower taxes, inclusion, rhetoric about freedom, limited government, all that stuff, which is quite different from the Trump message. And then number three, reversal, which you're seeing some hints of this week, is that the major parties in the U.S. would sort of switch places. The Democrats would become the party of business, which they already have to some extent. The Republicans would become the party of blue-collar America, and in that way could unseat whatever power the Democrats have left.
The reversal one in particular is quite intriguing because it echoes a pattern which we're seeing around the world. Certainly one thinks of here in the United Kingdom or in Australia, where the Labour Party in both places has gone from being the party of the working person to the party of the urban middle classes. Where the Republican Party is concerned, is there an argument that that's kind of been the course they've been on for a while, since Richard Nixon's Southern strategy of the 1970s, to win the South back for the Republican Party or win the South over to the Republican Party by doubling down on values issues?
Yes, but what's new this time is the economic component. You know, in the three possibilities that we just talked about, as I see it, two of the three, the remnant and the reversal scenarios, entail the Republicans moving left on economic issues as well as values or cultural issues. So that's what's new here, is a very loudly expressed skepticism about markets in general, particularly free trade, and market sectors in particular, particularly Silicon Valley and Wall Street. So when I was growing up, which was during the Southern strategy, and I grew up in the South, that's what you didn't hear from Republican politicians, is sort of bashing of big business and Wall Street. In effect, let's change the subject and talk about cultural and racial and ethnic stuff, not economic stuff.
Do you think there's any danger of it might be either an adjunct or acceleration of the remnant option or a fourth option entirely, where we see the party, as institutions sometimes do, embark on a full-scale nervous breakdown and just go completely Trump/QAnon, completely loopy?
It's always an option. I mean, I guess what's to me noteworthy about American politics is we've had the same two major parties for 160 years. In my many years of covering politics, I've often seen predictions that one or the other party had died. But what we had before us this week was the spectacle of two very closely matched parties. And the Republicans did much better than liberals expected them to do and much better than the polls said they would do. And to the shock of the Democrats, made big inroads, we think, with groups that you would think they had lost forever, like African Americans, Latinos, gay voters. So it's possible, but I think the evidence that we have immediately before us is the two parties are still very competitive with each other, and the Republicans are not a dying party.
Well, one distinguishing feature of the election we've just witnessed, and I can't think there's been any precedents I can think of in American presidential elections, is we've seen quite prominent members and quite prominent numbers of a particular party openly campaigning against it, the so-called Never Trump Republicans. And these are often people who throw back to what I think you're probably talking about as the restoration of the Republican Party, the sensible center-right conservative Reaganite party. Is there a way for those people to continue to be able to make their voices heard in a decisive manner, though? Because it strikes me that this is what any political party runs into when its crank faction gets hold of it, that you end up having to try and reason with the unreasonable or reason against the unreasonable, and that is very, very often a losing battle.
Well, it's that, but it's also that, you know, as I said a minute ago, these are very stable parties. And the idea of party loyalty, which is not a big deal to us journalists, is a big deal to people within these party organizations. So I think once you've left in the way that the Never Trumpers did, I don't think you're going to be welcomed back. There may be some exceptions to that, but the people who became really public and vociferous opponents of President Trump, I don't think are going to be able to go back. I mean, you said we hadn't seen this before. I want to go back again. I grew up in the South when it was 100% Democratic, and dozens and dozens and hundreds of politicians, you know, in my region of the country where I grew up, switch parties in much more numbers than the Never Trumpers. They were Southern Democrats who switched and became Republicans. So it has happened before, and the parties have pulled groups from each other over the years. Each party has an illogical coalition that is highly subject to change.
Just as a final thought then, and I know predicting the future right now is probably more of a fool's errand than it's ever been in American politics, but if we think of those options for the Republican Party that you'd outlined, the remnant, the restoration, and the reversal, which of those seems most likely to you?
Probably restoration. I don't know if it'll work, but by definition, the party, as understood as people who have the word Republican on their business cards, those are people, they grew up in the traditional Republican Party, they devoted their careers to it, and they're going to prefer restoration. That's what's comfortable to them. The problem with that scenario is the idea that it doesn't attract voters anymore. People seem to want a more economically interventionist government. And so if the Republicans say, we're all about being libertarian, I don't know if that pulls a constituency along with it. That's what Trump wasn't when he ran in 2016.
And that was Nicholas Lemon from The New Yorker speaking to me earlier. And that's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Christy Evans and Yolin Goffin. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. And until next time, goodbye.